Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, how the pandemic spiraled out of control in the U.S. Nearly 3.5 million people have tested positive for the coronavirus. The death toll now tops 135,000. Lori Garrett is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and pandemic expert. She says it didn't have to be this way.
You know, if you were to write a textbook of how to fail, we have followed that textbook.
Now, even as virus rates surge across the country, the White House seems to be sidelining our country's top health expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Lori Garrett joined me on Friday to talk about what, if anything, can be done to get the country back on track. Lori, there's clearly been a massive mismanagement of this pandemic here in the U.S. Talk about what our priorities should be at this point in our country.
Diane, we don't have a federal plan. We don't have real federal management. As a result, we don't really have any executed policy of any kind. What we have is a very fragmented state by state, county by county, even city by city set of strategies, which can be internally contradictory, so that we have situations where, for example, Miami has a different policy than the governor of Florida, and they are in opposition to one another. Here in New York, we had moments when the mayor of New York City was taking an opposite stance from the governor of the state, even though they are in the same party. It's resulted in a situation where at any given moment, two municipalities may be competing against each other for PPE supplies, may be competing against each other for economic revival, depending on, you know, the priorities of political leaders. I was asked earlier today in a conference call with a group of business investment leaders, you know, what I thought was going to be the ultimate strategy in all this. I said, it's chaos. It's going to continue to be chaos. And anybody that says otherwise isn't paying attention. So that's why the United States is number one in the world for COVID. Number one in the world for death toll, for case count. And unlike all our allies, all our, you know, OECD partners, our epidemic is soaring upwards, even as they have all bell-shaped curved gone down and are now dealing with smaller brush fires instead of a conflagration.
What should we be doing right now? Do you think we should shut down completely? What's your thinking?
Well, the problem, Diane, is that we don't have a strategy. So a shutdown is a tactic. Wearing a mask is a tactic. Opening or closing schools, these are tactical decisions. But tactics are only as good as the overall strategic framework. And we don't have one. We don't have one nationally, and no city has one, no county has one, and there is no global strategic plan. So nations, for the first time, are really fragmented as well. Even within Europe, they're having a hard time keeping a consistent set of EU policies and priorities in place. So I think where we are right now is we're 6 months into this pandemic. There are successes, quote unquote, in some places on the planet where they've managed, like China, to at great cost bring their epidemic under control into some sort of predictable size and deal with the brush fires as they appear. There are skyrocketing out of control situations, which combined in four nations account for more than half of all cases and deaths. That's the United States, India, Brazil, and Russia. And there are deep, dark secrets where we don't really know what's going on in key parts of the world. North Korea, for example, which continues to claim no cases. Kazakhstan, where the president declared it was illegal to use the phrases COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, or Wuhan virus, or any of that. And as a result, all we know is they have a heck of a lot of, quote, mystery pneumonia in Kazakhstan. And we have no real acknowledged leadership on a global scale. WHO is under fire and underfunded and desperate and trying to provide leadership, but not universally admired at this time.
So compare what we have done or not done with Canada and what they have succeeded in doing.
If you look at the Johns Hopkins University daily map of the world, which puts red circles, and the density and size of the circle indicates the numbers of total cumulative reported cases and deaths in given places around the world. And that is against a black background. So if you have no cases, the space is black. You look at North America and there is this sharp line, 2,000 plus miles across, right? And above the line, it's black. And below the line, it's crimson, all red. Right? The only difference between them is that's the border of Canada and the United States. I know people say, well, it's more sparsely populated, so of course they have fewer cases. Right, but on a per capita basis, we have four times the per capita rate of infection that Canada has. And mind you, that's with very large cities like Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, and so on. And even in their largest, most densely populated cities, they have a per capita incidence of COVID-19 that puts us to shame.
So how did they do it?
Well, they have several assets in Canada. First of all, they have a sense of national civil behavior. You know, we always make jokes about Canadians being so polite. Well, there's an upside to that. And the upside is they do take civil duty and civic society seriously, which we clearly do not in the United States. Secondly, they don't have a massive culture war that has divided their entire population against itself. Third, they have a leader who took this epidemic seriously from day one, and they have a national health service so that every single Canadian has access to healthcare at an affordable rate. And because they have a national health service, they have a single uniform set of policies for how to tackle and a strategic scheme for how to tackle the virus that cuts across from Vancouver to Montreal to all the way out to Newfoundland and Halifax and so on. And then finally, you know, their most difficult region to reach and to provide healthcare to, the far north, which is mostly of First Nation tribes. They have a real infrastructure there of health, and they've taken the COVID situation very seriously. So it's just pretty much the flip opposite of our situation. We have no coherent national health strategy. We have no coherent plan for bringing healthcare to everybody affordably in our nation. So we still have millions, despite Obamacare, who lack any health insurance. We provide almost nothing for our immigrant population, and we have active opposition at a government level to immigrants, so that they are afraid to seek healthcare, they are afraid to get tested, they are afraid to engage, yet they, of course, need the money, so they're going to jobs that put them at risk. We have a giant culture war that divides our nation right down the middle, red state, blue state, but also is dividing us, not surprisingly, by the number one issue that always divides us, racism. And, you know, here we are in the middle of COVID, and we're debating whether Jefferson Davis statues should be removed. So this is, you know, if you were to write a textbook of how to fail, we have followed that textbook.
What about Brazil? Surely that represents another extreme.
If there's any country that's doing worse than us, it's Brazil. Jair Bolsonaro has consistently, even as he is now himself infected, insisted that the virus is basically harmless, that hardly anybody gets really seriously sick from it, and very few people die from it, even as they are building mass graves all over Brazil. You know, bulldozers are burying the dead because they are piling up. We have no data that anybody really believes is accurate coming out of Brazil. So as bad as the numbers are, they are surely in reality much worse, both in terms of cases and deaths. And of course, a real toll is being taken among the indigenous peoples of the Amazon. It's like the arrival of measles with the first colonial visits from the white folks coming from Europe to Brazil. And it seems to be taking an especially terrible toll for them.
Laura, you've written that so much of the surge in the U.S. is coming from four sources: prisons, meatpacking businesses, bars, churches, and other large gatherings. Are these things that we ought to be taking a long pause on?
Well, we can certainly say that this is how this virus spread. So let's look at one of the great success stories so far, Japan. They've kept their COVID situation under very good control. The numbers have been quite modest all along, even though there have been plenty of visitors and travelers that have come and reintroduced COVID over and over again in Japan. And this is because they took an approach that said, let's target clusters. So, you know, in their understanding of the epidemiology, which is pretty much the exact opposite of Sweden's approach, they have said, what we have to do is test constantly, screen populations, and have, you know, surrogate test groups. We can't test every single Japanese citizen regularly, but we can create test groups that are ways of measuring what's going on in school children or what's going on in jailed populations or whatever targeted group you're talking about. And as soon as they see a case, very aggressive contact tracing takes place where they go from that one case outwards in every direction to find out who was that person in contact with, who were they in contact with, and who was the next layer out in contact with, and then test all of them. And any who test positive are placed under quarantine in their homes, or if they don't have a home setting that's suitable, then they're placed in a hotel or some designated facility for a minimum of 2 weeks. And in this way, they've completely held COVID under control.
Now, we've done some contact tracing.
Very little.
Very little.
We have no strategic testing really going on. So testing is completely random in America. It's who lined up in their car at the Walmart parking lot on Thursday. That's the testing. It's not, okay, we know nursing homes are an issue. Let's set up sentinel nursing homes where we routinely test, you know, 50 randomly selected patients and 10 randomly selected staffers every Monday morning. You know, something of that nature, so that you create canaries in the coal mine to monitor and to keep on top of. But instead, we just keep having these gatherings that result in clusters. So if you look at the list, and the New York Times just this week posted a complete rundown of clusters across America. If you look at the list of the clusters that have resulted in more than 1,000 cases, they are prisons, jails, meatpacking sites, large church gatherings, and big bars.
Bars.
And each of these ends up resulting in a different demographic spread of who, you know, are the secondary and tertiary contacts. And so it makes us, if you know, it's like that famous parable of the 8 blind men that surrounded an elephant. And one grabbed the trunk and said, you know, it's a snake. And one grabbed the tail and said, it's this, and so on. If you look at one cluster, you could decide that the only people at risk are over 80, because that happens to be a cluster that derived from a nursing home.
Right.
And if you look at another cluster, you could decide the only people at risk are, you know, 25 years old, because that came from a bar next to a college campus, right? Or the only people at risk are African American because it happens to be a cluster that came from a Baptist church revival. So what we need is a far more sophisticated approach to all this epidemiology and to understanding who's getting it, how they're getting it, and how they're spreading it. But instead, we just keep flailing around, and the Trump administration, every time the Centers for Disease Control reaches a conclusion that goes against the overarching strategy of the White House, they dismiss it, or they actually order CDC to go back and redo it in order to have their policy align more closely with the White House. And what is the White House strategy? The White House strategy is twofold. One, get the stock market roaring. Two, get the president reelected.
And now President Trump is demanding that schools from K through 12 reopen across the country. But state officials are saying, we can't do that safely without a lot more money. Is money the answer here?
Well, if you don't have the proper epidemiology in place to tell you what's going on with kids and what's the relationship between kids as carriers of disease and adults they may be exposed to, and how much risk is there from a 5-year-old versus a 12-year-old versus a 17-year-old, and what are the best ways for a group of 5-year-olds to commingle, and can they do it without spreading disease? I would argue there's no way to have 5 5-year-olds in a room without disease transmission. That's just, you know, let's just say it. They are little grabbers and droolers and biters and touchers. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And so the problem is the president, or any policymaker that's saying, reopen all the schools. Why do they want to reopen the schools? Well, on the benevolent side, you could argue kids can't go very long without proper socialization. And that's about being with other kids, with peers. And that is true. I worry greatly about kids missing nursery school and being alone, hunkered down for all these months with just two parents. What does that 3-year-old think it is to be a social being? How do you interact with another 3-year-old? Kids need to be with kids. And of course, the education interruption is really serious. And I think everybody is recognizing that virtual learning is no substitute for in-person disciplined schooling. And the other part of the problem is, any standards that are created, let us say that California sets a statewide set of standards for reopening schools and says all schools must have only this density of kids per classroom, these kinds of plexiglass barriers or whatever they would go for. Well, all of that involves money. It may involve more teachers or teachers with longer hours because you're going to have them do double session on schooling.
Yeah.
It may involve building additional classrooms or dividing classrooms in ways physically that they are not currently divided. It may involve setting up a screening center so that every child goes through some kind of a tunnel with a set of screening checks before entering into the general school. A whole long list of things, but these all are costly. They may incrementally be a few $1,000s, but you add it up.
Of course.
And what you're saying is there will be one level of safety for Chevy Chase and the Chevy Chase public school system, and another level of safety for Harlem, New York, and the inner city school district. And we're going to let those Harlem kids die or carry disease to their families. But we're going to make sure Chevy Chase is so safe that it's like going inside of a bubble. Without appropriate distribution of resources, we will have a class distribution, and I mean by that social economic class, of disease.
Well, and of course, the school situation also involves those parents who are kept from working at their own jobs because instead they're focused on those kids. So there is a negative impact on families as a whole when children are kept at home. But on the other hand, if you make insufficient provisions for them to go back to school, I mean, we're in between a rock and a hard place.
Well, and I would just add to that, it's one thing to be a college educated, let's say, publishing industry editor, and you're locked down at home with a 8-year-old and a 12-year-old. Your math skills might not be up to par, but you can probably walk your kid through the basic substitute for teaching that they might get in a real classroom once they're off the virtual. And it's a huge burden. And a lot of parents are complaining that they're having a hard time balancing their work time, any sort of personal sanity time, and being a teacher time, right? But it's quite another thing if English is your second language, you never in your own personal schooling studied American history. You never in your personal schooling studied 90% of the things your kids are learning.
Right.
And also you're trying to work as a delivery guy or, a frontline worker of some kind. Then your child is already way behind, way behind.
More of my conversation with Laurie Garrett when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Laurie Garrett. Laurie, talk about the recent questions that have been raised about the extent the virus can be infectious in an aerosol state.
So from the very beginning, since the earliest moments in the Wuhan outbreak, we've had controversy, inconsistent studies, and so on regarding airborne transmission. And there's a couple of reasons for confusion, and then I'll tell you where we really are, what I think is reality. The reasons for confusion are this is a coronavirus. Also in the class with this virus are common cold viruses, which are very contagious, of course, and SARS, which is less contagious, and MERS, which most of the time is only contagious within hospitals or from camels to people. So we haven't had a lot of general community transmission person to person of MERS. So it presents with a very confusing range of transmission. We know with the common cold coronaviruses that the real key to transmission is large droplets, meaning you're coughing visible bits of spittle and what have you that have virus in them, sneezing, and then your hands, which then touch doorknobs, touch common surfaces, and transmit the coronavirus that way. And we know with SARS that it was primarily a hospital virus. It spread primarily inside of medical facilities. And that put the emphasis on the need for strict PPE.
Right.
Masks, gloves, everything. So this virus already breaks all those rules. And what we now know is that the SARS-CoV-2 virus, it first of all appeared as a respiratory virus because all the original diagnoses in China were about pneumonia cases. But we now know the virus actually targets the entire cardiovascular system. so that it's destroying kidneys, it's destroying vascular systems, it's resulting in lowered oxygen to the brain and neurological symptoms. It has profound effects on the entire immune system. And we know now that the primary mode of transmission is into your nose. So you're inhaling it through the very form of inhalation that you can't really control. I mean, you can close your mouth, but very few people are going to walk around all day with their nose clamped shut. So unless you wear a mask that thoroughly covers your nose, you're basically out there being exposed. So now the next question was, well, is it just heavy droplets like common colds? And some of the original advice that downplayed the need to use masks, including advice I gave back in January, argued that the SARS experience told us masking for the general population was not essential. But that was because it was thought the virus was only carried in relatively large droplets that were transmitted by people who were sick.
I see.
In other words, you're coughing, you're tearing up, and you have lots of virus in this liquids that you're emitting one way or another. We now know that anywhere from 40 to 55% of transmission is from people with no symptoms at all. And that they are not coughing, they are not unusually spreading, they're simply talking. They're simply singing. We have a whole set of now four or five big studies done of church choirs that show the act of singing from a choir is spreading virus to the whole church. We have studies that show cheering in stadiums, crowds cheering, that's spreading virus. But we now know the virus is carried in micro droplets that are not visible to the human eye. It does have to be inside of some kind of liquid, but this is, you know, a few molecules of water surrounding the virus. And in that form, it's not particularly gravitationally susceptible. So large droplets, we were less worried about because they only transmit depending on how you propelled them. So if I cough, it might get 4 feet and then drop to the ground. Right. Gravity right. takes over.
Right.
Micro droplets simply go into the air and drift about, get caught on air currents, and move around in an airspace based on the general movement of air streams in the space. So an enclosed space with no open windows and no venting system can be a contaminated airspace for a very long time. You only need one individual. Think of it as a cocktail party. Imagine 20 people in a cocktail party in an enclosed space. One individual is a carrier. They're having normal conversation, milling about, moving from one cluster to another, chit-chatting, drinking. As everybody drinks more, they get a little louder, they get a little more laughing, spreading virus. Then you look 2 weeks later and half the cocktail party was infected. So that's bars. That's what's going on in bars. And we now understand that everybody really does need to wear a mask, and that what I keep saying over and over again is open your darn windows. But of course, offices built since the 1960s don't have openable windows.
Exactly.
And airplanes don't have openable windows. And a lot of bars and a lot of restaurants don't have openable windows, or if they do, they're not for you, the customer, to open. They're for the, you know, owners, the establishment to control.
So bottom line should be, do not open the bars all over the country.
Or put them outside and make everybody be outside. And while they're outside, make them be far apart from one another.
Exactly. Laurie, you said back in early May that for us to be through this, the best case scenario is about 3 years. Do you still feel that way?
Well, actually, we're mishandling things so tremendously And when I say we, I mean the whole planet, that 3 years is probably overly optimistic. At this point, I see two scenarios. The first scenario, optimistic scenario, is that we actually do come up with a vaccine or perhaps a combination of vaccines that offers better than 50% protection, but not a home run. I very much doubt we'll see a home run vaccine anytime soon that offers better than 90% protection, as we expect from most vaccines, and that requires only one dose and can be readily and affordably used by the whole world. So what's most likely is if we have an effective vaccine in the next 18 to 24 months, it will be partially effective, it will require boosters, it will be expensive, and the majority of the world will not have access to it. So in rich countries, some subset of the population will get vaccinated. We don't know how long the vaccination will last, what the durability of protection is. It might be only a year or two. Tony Fauci has been trying to warn everybody about this, but most people are not paying attention. And so far, we don't really know much about all the vaccines in the pipeline because most of these companies are giving us information by press release, not real scientific data. And I don't trust anything from a pharmaceutical company in a press release. Nobody should, because the press release is targeted to the stock market. It's not targeted to science. It's not targeted to policymakers. And so it will always put the best possible spin on any data they may have and make it look as good as possible.
So if you were...
Diane, if I may, sorry to interrupt, but sure. I said there's two scenarios. So the first one is you have a vaccine. The whole world doesn't get vaccinated in any short term. So we struggle with a vaccine-based strategy of control here, there, and everywhere, trying to put out little fires as they emerge. Scenario two is we don't have a really effective, safe, easy-to-use vaccine anytime soon. And the virus has an opportunity to spread into every nook and cranny of the planet, with the result that we now have a new endemic permanent threat to humanity, just as we did with HIV. So this will be the second great failure of modern time to control a newly emerging disease and stop a pandemic when it was stoppable.
And your belief as to the two scenarios?
Which one do I think is more likely? Ooh, well, every additional day that shows the lack of any strategic plan and any globally agreed to effort puts us closer to the second scenario of permanent endemic disease.
Aren't you also talking about a total division, even greater than already exists, between those with the means, the resources to take care of themselves, and those who do not?
Well, of course. I mean, let me just give you an anecdote to respond to that. I live in a large apartment building in New York. And over the course of this spring, when we were at our height of this epidemic in New York City, I was hearing 24/7 ambulances. And sometimes if my windows were open, I was hearing 16, 17 different ambulances roaring by at once. And down the street was a staging ground where at any given time there were 20 or 30 ambulance crews awaiting call and dispatch. And down the street in another direction was the primary intake hospital for my area getting COVID cases. During this time, people who had other underlying conditions were essentially going untreated. And we lost three people in the building, all of whom were elderly folks who had other health conditions. One was a 98-year-old woman who basically needed a home care nurse, no longer was getting one because it was too dangerous amid COVID for a home care nurse to show up, and she simply deteriorated. Another was an individual who had been struggling with dementia, and it just rapidly worsened. She went to a nursing home, and her husband was not allowed to see her. She just kind of gave up the ghost. And he, who was a stroke victim, once he heard his wife died, he simply laid down and died himself. So they're not counted as COVID deaths, but I think all three of them would be alive today if we hadn't had that background of the horror of COVID going on. And we're going to see this play out now in the southern states, a similar pattern of individuals who are unable to obtain their ongoing health care appropriately or feel cut off from humanity, cut off because they're in a nursing home that won't allow visitors, or cut off because suddenly the individuals who were their caretakers are no longer available or no longer allowed to see them. And it's very hard. It's hard enough to be 98 years old, let's face it. That's quite a hallmark to have reached that age. But it's especially hard if you feel isolated from humanity. If you feel that there's no human touch, there's no contact. And frankly, you know, putting your loved ones on your cell phone is a poor substitute for having them at your bedside.
One last political question. What do we lose if the U.S. is no longer a member of the World Health Organization?
Withdrawing from the World Health Organization is a phenomenal mistake on so many levels. I've written about it. I've written my opinion of it, but I certainly could have written 10,000 words, 20,000 words. The list is so long. Not only is it a slap in the face to the whole rest of the world, especially the poor world that is so dependent on WHO, and a slap in the face to the institution, we are, of course, responsible for about half of the funding of WHO. So it's a tremendous undercutting of their financial wherewithal in the middle of a pandemic when their needs level is far higher than normal. But it's more than that. WHO, for all its flaws, has tremendous convening authority. And one of the issues they're convening on is a new treatment for diabetes type 2, or whether or not hydroxychloroquine is a reasonable therapy for COVID-19, or deciding on what looked to be the dominant strains of influenza in circulation in a given time, and therefore determining what should be the content of the next season vaccine for influenza. We will no longer be part of those processes. And that is a two-way threat. They lose our expertise and we lose our engagement in the process, which means, if I'm at CDC and my job is influenza and I no longer can attend those meetings, I no longer am part of the process of determining what the global influenza vaccine should be, all I can do is call up my counterpart in Australia or in UK or France or wherever it is I have a buddy and say, well, what happened in the meeting? And what should we prepare for? And what should I tell our drug companies to do? So all we've effectively done is shoot ourselves in our own feet. And it's a really stupid, stupid thing. And of course, in terms of political goodwill, we've basically flipped our middle finger up to the rest of the world. And meanwhile, they're looking at us and saying, what a pitiful situation. All these decades, we thought America was the leader of the free world. America was the leader of science. America was the leader of democracy. We loved your country. We held you up as the model in everything that we engaged in. And in times of trouble, we counted on you. And now you turn out to be a pathetic failure. You can't control one darn virus. And all you want to say to the rest of the world is, it's your fault. You want to call it a China virus. You want to blame China for it. You want to insist that France took all the PPEs or Switzerland has to give you their vaccine. Why, you turn out to be the emperor with no clothes. It's a terrible situation.
Laurie Garrett, thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Laurie Garrett. She is a former senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations and a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer. You can find her latest work at Foreign Policy. And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansferk of Wonderly. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all, and please don't forget to wear a mask. I'm Diane Rehm.